So I'll stand up here just because I can use the keyboard and stuff up here. Well, thanks very much for inviting me to do this talk. It's a definite honour to be here in at York University, which I've known about for a long time. It's hard not to, if you're coming from a certain political angle, to not to know about all these great thinkers who've come from here. So I want to talk about the subject about the global development crisis and the possibilities of labour-centred development. This is a cover of the book, which I all urge you to buy. And if you can't buy it, I'm sure there's a free copy lurking somewhere on the internet. So it's there. It's all available for you. So this is me. This is where I'm coming from. So basically, what I want to do in this talk is do three things broadly. First of all, talk about the ideology of development as in the mainstream conceptions of development and how it reproduces the crisis that I'm going to talk about, explain this crisis and explain alternative conceptions of development, the idea of labour-centred development. I should just say something about the reason I wrote this book. One of them was because you can't get funding to do any research in the UK. So the only kind of research you can do is sitting in your office writing theory. So that's one of the reasons. But more interestingly, perhaps, is that I had the fortune to teach at the London School of Economics in the Destin Department, Department for International Development. And me and my friends were talking once, and we were sitting around saying, yeah, you know, these the professors here and the whole atmosphere is quite critical, isn't it? I mean, you know, they're obviously anti-neoliberal, apart from one person who's neoliberal. But they're anti-neoliberal, and they like to talk about all these theorists, but they don't never talk about Marx. And we classify them as the anyone but Marx brigade. And so this is why I wrote this book, because I've got chapters in this book. There's eight chapters. The first and the last chapters, the first chapter starts off with an analysis of the crisis, some data. The last chapter puts forward my idea about labour-centred development. And then I've got six chapters in the middle which deal with the big thinkers. So the first chapter is Friedrich List, who they love. The second chapter is on Marx, who they don't talk about. Third chapter is on Trotsky and Gershenkron, they talk about Gershenkron a lot, but not Trotsky, even though Gershenkron got all of his ideas from Trotsky, very much obviously so, and his grandson told me that. That he was influenced by Trotsky. Then there's a chapter on Joseph Schumpeter. Then there are chapters on Karl Polanyi and Amartya Sen. So they use all of these thinkers, apart from Marx and Trotsky, to explain the world in ways that are much better than mainstream conceptions of development. When I say mainstream, I mean the kind of World Bank economist conception. So they use all of these to mount important critiques of the nature of the development process, historically, contemporarily, theoretically, but they don't talk about Marx or Trotsky. And my argument is that all of these thinkers engage with Marx, apart from List, who Marx engaged with himself, because List was writing before Marx really got going. In fact, you could almost say that all of these thinkers are engaged in an explicit or implicit critique of Marx to show that they do it better than he does. But my argument is that Marx does the analysis of capitalism much better than all of these. He explains why they analyse capitalism like they do, if we have a fruitful engagement. And he provides us with a much broader explanation of the nature of capitalism itself. In other words, he provides the ultimate critique, which these thinkers are not able to. And the fact that the colleagues at Destin and in other university departments are happy to use all these thinkers, apart from Marx and Trotsky, shows the relative weakness of development studies. So let's just think about the crisis and the nature of the crisis. The crisis is actually quite straightforward. On the one hand, there is a huge amount of wealth in the world, and despite the global financial crisis, it continues to grow minute by minute, month by month, year upon year. At the same time, there is a huge amount of poverty in the world that also is hard to shift. So one statistic really says a lot. Oxfam produced a document in 2014 saying that the 85 richest people were as wealthy as the poorest half of the world. So you can easily think, well, you know, if distribution was higher up on the agenda, then that wealth could be used for much better things. The problem with development studies is it cannot see this crisis. So it talks about all kinds of other crises, and that's why you have this proliferation of subjects within development studies, like human security and security studies and so on. But it cannot see this fundamental crisis, and it can't even get anywhere near explaining it. And part of the reason for that is that development studies is part of a hegemonic discourse. I wrote something for the Bullet for the Socialist Project, and I said how you can think of development, mainstream development thinking, in the same way that George Orwell described doublethink. It's using knowledge to attack knowledge. It's using morality to deform morality. It's pretending to be ethical while completely undermining ethics. And doublethink and Foucault's ideas of discourse, where description is not just description of material reality, but is also imbued with power in order to reproduce the power relations that are being described. This is what all development studies is engaged in. And actually, development studies thinking, most of it justifies the concentration of wealth on a mass scale, as I've noted, whilst appearing to do something about poverty, but not. So, for example, one example of this discourse or this double think is that the United Nations, the World Bank, people like Jeffrey Sachs, they talk about how global poverty now is being reduced at a breakneck speed. The MDG number one was supposed to halve it between 1990 and 2015, and they're all very proud that they've achieved that 5 years in advance. Isn't it great? All the world leaders from Cameron to Obama are praising themselves, patting themselves on the back. They're going forward and saying, while we destroy the welfare state in our countries, we want to get rid of poverty by 2030 completely. Who could be against that? Everyone wants to get rid of poverty, and they are at the forefront of that. So they are portraying themselves as the benign masters of the universe to achieve the end of poverty. And of course, behind their arguments is the standard argument that capitalism can bring development for all, it can deliver for all. Other examples of this discourse can be seen in the International Labour Organization, which talks about the growing world middle class, or the growing middle class in developing countries. Now, people like Martin Ravalion, World Bank figure who came up with the $1 a day poverty line, he is now saying that the developing world middle class, those people living above $2 a day, purchasing power parity. The International Labour Organization talks about $4 a day and above being representative of the middle class. Bill Gates started off this year by saying, and I quote, by almost any measure, the world is better than it ever has been. You know, obviously for a billionaire like him, or a trillionaire perhaps, of course it looks good. I mean, if we had that money, it would look great. But this is not just a small minority of people saying that. It is, in a sense, the kind of end of history being sought for. The end of history can be attained by 2030. We can eliminate poverty. Capitalism by 2030 will have delivered the goods to everyone. And this is almost what the development agencies are engaged in. And a lot of development studies have got sucked into that discourse and is unable to get a bearing on reality. So I want to talk about the way they conceptualize this in theoretical terms, the way they justify it. Because they do provide a strong analysis of the world in a sense that is an attractive one. They talk about what I call a residualist conception of development. My alternative is the relational conception, which I'll come to later. But let's talk about the residualist conception. Residualist conception of development and underdevelopment starts with the basic assumption that the world's poor are poor because they are excluded from the benefits of capitalism. They're poor because they're excluded from the benefits of capitalism. The other side of that assumption is the world market equals a ladder, a benign ladder of Opportunitian wealth. So, for example, Jeffrey Sachs, the good friend of Bono, the great tax avoider, the purveyor of awful music, the great self-promoter. I mean, they're both great friends. Jeffrey Sachs has been described as a kind of Jekyll Hyde character from someone who has probably got blood on his hands from the 1990s to now, the kind of fluffy guy who promotes well-being for all. But Jeffrey Sachs, in his book, The End of Poverty, he says, he castigates people like us, he castigates those people who campaign against sweatshops in the global south, and he says, and I quote, The proliferation of sweatshop labour across the world is as the sweatshops are the first rung on the ladder out of extreme poverty, and we should be supporting the expansion of these kinds of sweatshops. So he says that. And this is just one example. The common assumptions about the poor within development thinking, the mainstream, this is, when I'm saying mainstream now, I'm talking really about the World Bank, The Economist, the kind of liberal mainstream. The liberal mainstream are as follows. These are the assumptions. They are the disempowered who need to be empowered by the elites. The primary development actors are combinations of states and entrepreneurs who incorporate the poor into dynamic economic sectors. Ultimately, the poor are the objects of development and the elites are the subjects. Development is undertaken on behalf of the poor by the elites. And the most hardest version of that is by Paul Collier, who advocates neocolonial intervention to depose dictators and impose benign markets and benign political structures. But it's basically an elite system of thinking. And right at the heart of this residualist perspective, there are a number of further assumptions. So the market is the benign zone of exchange. Exchange takes place between individuals. So therefore, methodological nationalism is right at the heart of this relational, market-based approach. It's relations between individuals, not classes. Class has no meaningful explanation of development, wealth, or poverty, and class relations are really considered as the ILO does, as simple aggregates of individuals at different income levels. When you look at the ILO talking about different classes in the world, they've got this, I don't know, six or seven class stratification, and so from $0 to $2, from $2 to $4, up, you know, from 13 and up to about $50 a day. They've got their different class stratification. They've got no conception of the relation between classes. Now, these are that's at the heart of the residualist conception of development, and this leads, this is my argument, this leads to a fundamental paradox right at the heart of the mainstream development discourse. And that paradox is that the poor are forced to partake in an economic system that is based upon their oppression and exploitation. Of course, the purveyors of mainstream liberal ideology would say, no, we're all about increasing the opportunities. But as we shall see, as my argument proceeds, it is a system that forces them to be oppressed and exploited. So, for example, one way of thinking about this would be to look at what Friedrich von Hayek said in the mid-1970s. He said, and I quote, "I have not been able to find a single person, even in much maligned Chile, who did not agree that personal freedom was much greater under Pinochet than it had been under Allende." That's Friedrich von Hayek. Now, from his perspective, that personal freedom is truly greater under Pinochet because you don't have those interest groups of trade unions, which he hated so much, interfering in the allocation of resources. So they were destroyed, drowned in blood, and suddenly freedom increases. But the idea that freedom is derived from these market transactions is right at the heart of their way of thinking. The World Bank would say, this is a complete fallacy what you're talking about. It's not true. We are for increasing the benefits of capitalism to the world as a whole, and you can just look at the statistics that we provide showing that people are coming out of poverty. Millions, hundreds of millions falling out of poverty. But of course, they use the $1.25, $2 a day benchmark to analyse poverty, and most people realise that $1.25 or $2 is not a benchmark of which, if you're above it, you're out of poverty, but it's one of the meanest forms of measurement of poverty that's available. There's lots of other examples of thinking about poverty. So the New Economics Foundation says there should be a $5 a day poverty line. The Lant Pritchett, who used to work for the World Bank, now is at the Kennedy School. He talks about a $10 a day poverty line, and he says under this poverty line, something like 88% of the world's population live in poverty. And of course, if you look more closely, you'll find that the vast majority of the global labouring class live in poverty. So the World Bank's arguments really are based on statistical sort of trickery. Now, for example, if you, just to give you a couple more examples of this. So according to people like Martin Revalion, he would look at Cambodian textile workers who earn something like $75 a month as a minimum wage, and according to him, they are middle class. Now, I mean, ideologically, when I think about what middle class means, I think about a certain level of comfort. It says something about neoliberal ideology that what is we consider to be comfortable is now actually drudgery and extremely hard work. It shows the level of degradation of expectations that we can expect for the future. But they don't reflect on that. So he thinks if you're above $75 a day in Cambodia, you're middle class. The Asian Wage Floor Alliance, however, it shows that a living wage, which is enough to provide for a family's basic needs, is $283 a month, almost four times the minimum wage. So there you have an example of statistics being mobilised to show, to try and show that the poor, the exploited, the labouring classes of the world are not poor and exploited, but they're actually doing really well, they're middle class and they're very happy and we should be supporting them. That is an ideological drive by the World Bank and its supporters and neoliberal supporters generally. Now, the point is, when you look at slightly more humane measurements of poverty, you will find that the vast majority of the world's labouring class live in poverty. And the argument is that I'm making here is they are in poverty not because they are excluded from the system, but because they are exploited by global capitalism. Now, mainstream development discourse, and even the more critical versions, which I'm going to discuss in a second, really don't have much to say about the concept of exploitation. They see it again as somehow residual, men doing it to women in bad ways, unregulated sweatshops, and so on. Exploitation is marginal to their conception of capitalism. So, if we reject, which most critical thinking people do, if we reject this mainstream conception of liberal development, where are we? Where do we turn? And this is where I start engaging with the people that we turn to. The first one we turn to is Friedrich List, because not only is he one of the older thinkers, but also because the main alternative to liberal ways of thinking at the moment, statist political economy, I'm talking about people like Hajim Chang, Robert Wade, Alice Amsden, Atul Kohli, a whole range of thinkers say that the state should be playing a major role in the development process, and we need to understand the role of the state in delivering real human development. So, and they derive their ideas from Friedrich List. Now, Friedrich List's book, The National System of Political Economy, published in 1841, was, in a sense, a theorization of what he'd seen when he travelled to the United States in the 1820s and saw the American system of political economy, where contrary to the whole ideology that America is and was a free market economy, there was a huge amount of state intervention through all kinds of aspects, research and development, infrastructure development, and so on. So he saw that. He went to the United States as a free marketeer, as a Ricardian. He came back convinced of an alternative, the need for an alternative, and he formulated that book in his National System. And he starts off in that book by critiquing English hypocrisy, which is essentially very important now because that English hypocrisy is no longer English, but is the hypocrisy of the World Bank and the mainstream. Because, and it's captured very well in Hajun Chang's book, Bad Samaritans, which basically says, from the World Bank's view, you developing countries should do as we say, not as we did. We have license to be hypocrites. And List castigated the British, saying this is just a form of imperial manoeuvre to maintain an agricultural periphery while we, the British, achieve industrialisation and subordinate the rest of the world to our economic dominance. List is seen as the founder of infant industry theory, and the idea that the state should play a major role. He came up with the idea that there are three types of capital: natural, physical, and mental capital. And the mental capital, that is the workforce, the kind of machinery, the managerial cadre that could organise the workforce, this is the central area of the state's focus. And the state should aim to form a strong sector of mental capital that can be integrated with natural and material capital, that is natural resources and the raw materials used to in production. to generate a dynamic economic sector to break out of its peripheral position, such as the proto-German states were in relation to England. And he's been taken up by the latter-day statist political economists. And when you first encounter Friedrich List's ideas as popularised by these statist political economists, they are very attractive for the obvious reason that they describe a reality which the World Bank and mainstream development theory can't, and they advocate very concrete steps, and it seems to be worth doing because they can point to lots of historical evidence that shows state intervention works. But when you look at Marx's critique of List, Marx wrote this critique when he was just 26, he mounted a ferocious critique of List using all kinds of language that we wouldn't be allowed to use or allowed us to use ourselves in academic language. I mean, he's swearing at List. And he says, List mystifies the nature of the state, presenting it as a supra-class institution above class interests. And most importantly, Marx said about List that his conception of natural capital development is one that is based on the degradation of the worker. So, for example, this is a quote from Marx in 1845. He says, under the present system, that's the national system of political economy advocated by List, under the present system, if a crooked spine, twisted limbs, a one-sided development and strengthening of certain muscles, etc., make you more capable of working, that is, more productive, then your crooked spine, your twisted limbs, your one-sided muscular movement are a productive force. So Marx saw straight away that what List was advocating was actually the formation of a proletariat to be exploited and degraded. And Marx's critique stands up, I would argue. If we look at South Korea, we see in the 60s and 70s, we see massive exploitation of labour, the world's longest working week, very tight organisation of the labour process, smashing of trade unions, sending of trade unionists to concentration camps, total denial of democracy. If we look at contemporary China, which the statist political economists sometimes get quite excited about, we see similar processes at work, very high rates of exploitation. So Marx's critique is actually quite apt, and actually the statist political economists, they are reasonably honest. They're not like the World Bank and the liberals. They almost recognise this. In fact, they do. So let me just quote one of them. So this is a quote from one of the leading statist political economists and his reflections on the state, development and labour. So he says, the inclusion of labour is obviously desirable in principle, but note that if labour exclusion is part of a set of arrangements which generate high-speed growth, workers are protected to some extent by labour, the high labour demand. Labour exclusion also gives a government more room to manoeuvre when austerity comes, and that latitude can be used to restore fast growth more quickly. So they recognise that labour exclusion might be necessary. What that really means is, well, you can read what it means in terms of workers' lives. So for me, that somehow takes the shine off statist political economy and says to me, well, that's not really an alternative. Where else can we look for alternatives? Now, I'm not going to go through the whole book. I mean, the other theorists that I do talk about do provide some forms of alternative. I want to just talk about one who is the most popular today, and that's Amartya Sen and his idea of development as freedom, published in 1999, and a major book within development studies, and a real concept of development that is very attractive. Part of the reason it's so attractive is because he draws very heavily on Marx, and on Smith, and on Aristotle. So, you know, with that kind of pedigree, it's not, well, how far wrong can you go? Well, let's see. He doesn't talk about growth as the driver of development. He says the expanding freedoms should be the objective of development. So to quote his statement in the opening of the book, development can and should be understood as a process of expanding the real freedoms that people enjoy. This is a grand vision of development that has been lost since the so-called impasse of development studies in the mid-1980s, where it's been reduced. I mean, if you want to understand what the impasse is, go to any development studies journal and you'll see the boredom hits you right away when you look at the titles. That is a reflection of the impasse, the inability to grasp the big issues of development, that is class. You can't talk about that. Okay, well, we're going to write really boring stuff. And that applies for all the social sciences as well. I'm happy to make that argument. So Sen rejects that and he stands out from the crowd. He makes much more interesting arguments. But my argument is that he falls back into a residualist perspective where exclusion from the market rather than its form itself is the problem. He sees markets as an opportunity rather than oppressive force, and he is unable to develop a class analysis because he falls into a methodological individualism. So he talks, so let's just give an example of this idea of the residual approach that is inherent in Amartya Sen's thinking. He says, development consists of the removal of various types of unfreedoms that leave people with little choice, little opportunity of exercising their reasoned agency. So this idea of removing barriers to access of the market is quite apt, especially in India, where Sen is from, because, of course, there's lots of forced labour there. And who would disagree that challenging and combating forced labour would not be part of the development process? But does that mean that that's all it's about in terms of removing access to barriers to the market? Or removing barriers to access to the market? Because at the end of the day, what that really means is that workers should have the freedom to choose who they can be employed by, or in Marx's terms, who to be exploited by. That, for me, is a very limited conception of development. Sen goes further. He talks about the need for the role of the state, which is welcome in terms of providing all kinds of provision that the neoliberal economics denies. But he then castigates critiques of the market and critics of the market as follows. He says, to be generically against markets would be almost as odd as being generically against conversation between people. Exchange of words or goods or gifts are part of the way that human beings in society live and interact with each other, unless stopped by regulation or fiat. So, critics of the market are the same as people who are critics of conversation, because conversations are such a great sphere of freedom. Well, you know that they're not. Conversations can be just as oppressive as they can be emancipatory. You just think of when you're doing a PhD and you're getting told off for being lazy, and all kinds of other examples. The point is that Sen mirrors the residualist approach. The market's a sphere of opportunity, and exchange on markets occurs between individuals. So it's a methodological individualism, and there's a real limited conception of class. I mean, so when I said, how wrong can you go if you're drawing on Smith and Marx and Aristotle, I mean, he does go very wrong. He quotes Marx to... Marx has got lots of positive things to say about capitalism in relation to feudalism, but he only quotes us positive things. He never quotes Marx's critiques of capitalism. Why not, I wonder? For obvious reasons, because if he did, then he'd have dug himself into a hole which even he, with his great brain, wouldn't be able to get out of. So, there we have two of the big popular alternatives to mainstream development. These are not liberals, they are progressives in some way. In the current conjuncture, state-led economic development is in some ways preferential to neoliberalism, and Sen's ideas certainly of expanding freedom as a means of development is certainly more preferential to the idea of growth as a basis. So, but my argument is that they never fully escape the paradox of needing to force the masses, the mass of the population, into exploitative and oppressive conditions. And so my alternative is to turn to a relational political economy of development and to ask the following questions. And here I quote from Henry Bernstein, and he says, are some people poor because others are rich and vice versa? What are the mechanisms that generate both wealth and poverty? There's two sides of the same coin of capitalist development. Now, this is a relational question, because when we started off talking about the fact that 65 people own as much wealth as half of the world's humanity, mainstream development discourse and even statist and Senian approaches don't enable us to ask what is the relationship between this wealth on one hand and mass poverty on the other. A relational political economy does enable us to do that. And so class analysis is where we can do that from, and class analysis enables us to show what's wrong with the world and how to change it. But rather than just assuming, however, that class analysis offers us an easy solution, we do have to confront the fact that Marxism itself has not really helped its own cause over many years. I mean, there are all kinds of critiques of Marxism, some are more and less useful. So one of the critiques of Marxism, which is quite popular these days, especially in the UK, is that he was Eurocentric, and therefore those people outside the white working class have got nothing to learn from him. And of course you can read his writings in India and you can say, yes, this is awfully Eurocentric. And this is where the critique stops. But the you know, he's writing in 1853, he talks about the double mission of the British in India. It's still much more progressive than any thinkers of the time, and it's still much more progressive than people like Niall Ferguson or Deepak Lal today, but never mind. What's interesting, though, is that Marx changes his mind quite fundamentally. By 1857, he was talking about, with the Sepoy revolt in India, he's saying India is our best ally. He was supporting wholeheartedly the revolt in India, and he supported wholeheartedly the Taiping Rebellion. Later on, towards the end of his life, the Russian populists got in touch with Marx after his publication of Capital in Russian and asked, can we make the transition to socialism in our agrarian situation of agrarian backwardness, or do we have to follow the way that most of the Russian Marxists were saying at the time of industrialization following the Western path? And Marx was quite clear. He said to Vera Zasulich, you don't have to follow our path. This path, you couldn't follow it even if you wanted to. And he argued that the possibilities of the agrarian commune in Russia becoming the fulcrum of a new system of development were there. And he also argued quite clearly that the Russian commune could be the vanguard of a new world system based on socialism. So rather than looking at the white industrial working class, as it were, as the vanguards, he was looking at the backward Russian peasants, backward in inverted commas, as leading the transition to a different world system. In other words, to critique him of being Eurocentric is absurd. And I think the work by Kevin Anderson is a great book on that. But later Marxists have not been put off to try and make their brand of thinking as unattractive as possible. I mean, for me, being a Marxist is about supporting struggles by workers in any way you see them. But you've got these Marxists in the 70s saying the problem with the third world is not that it's exploited, but not exploited enough. We need more exploitation to drive up the development process. Other Marxists said we need to, quote, supportive of capitalist development in sub-Saharan Africa before there are class struggles for socialism. I mean, if you're a Marxist, why be a Marxist if you're going to make these points? I mean, liberals and statists can do it better than you can. There seems to be a terrible contradiction to be a Marxist saying we need more capitalist development. So my perspective is something quite different to that, and it's what I call labour-centred development. And it's not a utopian idea in the sense that we can only think about it in the future. It's existing right at this very minute across much of the world. And let me just show you some images of what I would consider to be the agents of labour-centred development. And this is in stark contrast to the elite ideas that the state bureaucrats and people like Richard Branson and the great entrepreneurs are the agents of development in the world. Now, here are Cambodian garment workers fighting the military police early January this year. Huge strike wave in China, which just continues to go up, which is incredible. The landless labourers movement in Brazil, the MST, occupying could be foreign-owned lands, it could be low Brazilian-owned lands, and setting up their own livelihoods. And here we have the occupied factories by Argentinian workers still going on, incredibly, after more than 10 years after the crisis. And in response to the great economic crisis of the early 2000s, Argentinian workers were faced with the option, either live a life of precarity, of unemployment and misery, or actually take matters into your own hands and take over the factories and start organising them. And what I found in some of my research on this is that actually, contrary to elite theories of development, these workers were able to increase productivity, increase output, increase employment, push wages up, and have a huge amount of space for democratic process within the workplace. And one of the reasons for that, which we won't be too surprised to hear, is that actually management is not necessarily about driving up best practice in the workplace, although they always say it is. It's about controlling labour. So once you get rid of these managers, you've actually got the place to think openly about how to organise the labour process in a way that would actually suit your interests. So the point here is that we have the idea of labour-centred development. All of these actions are contribute in one way or another to potential development for labouring classes. This diagram is a bit crude, but as you move from left to right, you see the development space opening up for labour, and is fundamentally based on question of class struggle. And on this extreme left, I should have done it the other way around, but extreme left, you see a situation where market development and state-led development, it doesn't show the interactivity, the specificities of the interaction, is a situation where the labour is basically, workers are reduced to their role as a carrier of a commodity, that is labour power. So you can think of Pinochet's Chile here, you can think of Park's South Korea there. Labour is nothing more than a bearer of the commodity of labour power. But through their own struggles, labouring classes can actually enlarge the developmental space and trajectory and processes within which they operate and create more space for themselves, so that they are not just bearers of labour power, but they are actually increasingly can realise themselves as full human beings, or at least partial and not sort of stunted in this way. So as we move across from left to right, we have experiments of participatory democracy, you have ideas of welfare, ideas of decommodification, all kinds of expansions of the sphere within which workers can actually make a difference. As you keep moving across to the right, where you see market and state being squeezed further out, you get the potential for economic democracy. So the picture I showed you before of the Argentinian workers occupying their factories, and this is an example of economic democracy, and this is where it does get a bit utopian, as in looking into the future, but, I mean, it exists now, this kind of economic democracy exists now. The normative part of this analysis is that the further you go there, that is the vision of development for the future, or that is potentially one of the visions of development for the future, i.e. economic democracy is something we could strive for, and some people would call, you can call it whatever you want, but we're talking basically about workers controlling the labour process, the labour regime, the organisation of work, investment, democracy within the workplace and beyond. Others would call it socialism, whatever you want to call it. This is a process of development that enhances workers' existence and enhances the allocation of resources in a way that actually leads to human fulfilment in a much greater way. We can talk about that more, but just to paraphrase someone you'll all be very familiar with, my conception of labour-centred development is one where the development of the poor must be achieved by the poor themselves. It's an anti-elitist. Of course, it understands that all kinds of alliances come into play. It's not ignorant or naive in that sense, but it does argue for the primacy of workers' collective action, a labouring class collective action, to achieve development. And of course, that is all the more complicated in this day, because people like Marcel van der Linden are writing very eloquently about the fact that we have this contradictory situation. On one hand, the global labouring class is now around 3 billion, larger than it ever has been. On the other hand, it's more fragmented than it ever has been, with all kinds of different types of work existing north and south, with all kinds of interpenetrations going on, which means that solidarity is difficult. But at least if we're thinking about that and analysing the problem, perhaps we won't be led up towards the wrong solutions. So just to summarise and to bring to an end the talk, it does raise the whole point about this talk and what I teach is to raise the question, what do we understand by development? It's to reject the idea that there is no alternative to liberal development. And it's also to say, are we thinking about economic growth? Are we thinking about catch-up development, which is what the statists think about? Are we thinking about a Senian perspective where freedom is considered as your ability to choose who to sell your labour power to? That's quite limited. Are we thinking about decent work, which is what the ILO goes on about as its developmental strategy, looking to the past and bowing down to business as it does so? I would say we can think about much greater forms of development, and we don't have to be utopian about it. We don't have to talk about a glorious socialist future, although we may want to think about it. We can look at concrete processes of struggle and change now that do represent what I would say is an attempt by labouring class organisations to ameliorate their livelihoods, which is why I'd call it labour-centred development. And the very last point is, why go on about the concept of development when it's been such a devalued word? I mean, when people like Cameron and Obama use the word development and the World Bank uses it, where you think, well, maybe we should come up with a new phrase. Because what they've done is they have taken a beautiful concept, repackaged it, emptied it out of all its progressive meaning, turned it into an oppressive concept, and sell it back to us asking us to be grateful as a result of their actions. But the reason that I go on using this term development is because Marx himself used it quite a lot, and he really did capture what I'm trying to talk about here. He talks about how capitalist development distorts the worker into a fragment of a person. In contrast, he argued for a social system where the development of all human powers is the end itself. He talked about how that system would establish a society where the free development of each is a condition for the free development of all. And he says, in the act of producing their lives, the producers change too, in that they bring around new qualities in themselves, develop themselves in production, transform themselves, develop new powers and new ideas, new modes of intercourse, new needs, and new languages. So he does realize intellectually the potential of human development, and part of the rationale for writing the book is to try and get that back into development studies in one way or another. So thanks very much.
Now, Stephanie's gone off to teach a class, so I'm glad she asked me to take over. So I'll keep things going for our panelists. And did you guys arrange an order, or have you agreed?
Just by the poster.
Okay. So we'll start with Viviana.
Okay, great. Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. And thank you very much, Ben, for the presentation and for your choosing York to spend this term with us. And as somebody within the field of development with an interest in labor, I really want to extend particular thank you for actually bringing these two fields together in a way that it is very, I think, has become increasingly difficult to find. And so in many ways, I find your contribution refreshing and also encouraging as in thinking of the field. But of course, there are some warnings that probably I would like to share with you in some of the perils of this. And it's interesting that you actually finished your presentation with a point about why development. That was actually going to be one of my questions to you, because beyond the fact that it is a very broad field in which I think labor should be a primary importance, there is also a very contested issue, starting with what do we mean by development. And of course, we are not going to bore the audience with the question, because we won't find an answer anyway. But of course, notions, for example, of human development itself could set you in some tension, I think, and therefore. It might be a good idea to talk, why do we need to conceive of development and qualify it in these ways, and which is very much essential to the whole industry around development too, right? Like the fact that we are always seem to be finding one more layer that needs to be explained and accounted for. Having said that too, I think that there is some danger in talking about development with a capital D, right? Because development is many things to many people. And I guess somebody like me would also say, well, not all development is really mainstream development. It only constitutes a part of the discussion. And so probably it would be good, I think, to hear you a little bit about why you have chosen to frame this discussion within the field of development. Well, that was one of the points I wanted to make about your presentation and your book, which, again, is a very fascinating read. There are two further points that I would like to make. And the first one... the first one has to do with the concept of labor